Good evening. I'd like to welcome everyone to the Simple Actions Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm a member of Simple Alcoholics Actions Anonymous, Simple Actions Home Group. I'm an alcoholic, and my name is David.
Hey, David.
For those who care to join us, let's have a moment of silence to do with as you wish, followed by the Serenity Prayer. God,
grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference.
Amen. The Simple Actions Group wishes to extend a warm welcome to all in attendance this evening. These premises are non-smoking. Our group is welcome to use this room and the restrooms exclusively, which are across the main foyer and up a small flight of stairs. At this time, please silence your cell phones. If I had mine, I would. Also, we respectfully ask those present to refrain from unnecessary moving around the room. This will keep distractions and disturbances to a minimum and allow everyone to listen uninterrupted. This group practices the spiritual foundations of anonymity, singleness of purpose, and effective sponsorship. As a group, we believe that Alcoholics Anonymous provides alcoholics with a set of clear directions on precisely how to recover from the illness of alcoholism on the basis of simple actions. These actions are contained in the book, Alcoholics Anonymous. It is the purpose of this meeting to carry that clear message and to focus on precisely how to recover from the illness of alcoholism on the basis of AA's simple actions. The AA preamble states, Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. The format of this meeting is an open Big Book step study. As a group, we recognize the power of one alcoholic identifying with another alcoholic, sharing their experience, strength, and hope from the book Alcoholics Anonymous. We encourage you to engage in conversation and ask questions after the meeting pertaining to the step discussed tonight. And tonight we are on step 4, part 2, fear and sex. Please welcome our panel this evening. We have Delia and Toby. So, let's see. Step 4, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. We will start the reading on page 67 in the Big Book. Notice the word fear is bracketed alongside the difficulties with Mr. Brown, Mrs. Jones, the employer, and the wife. This short word somehow touches every aspect of our lives. It was an evil and corroding thread. The fabric of our existence was shot through with it. It set in motion trains of circumstances which brought us misfortune we felt we didn't deserve. But did not we ourselves set the ball rolling? Sometimes we think fear ought to be classed with stealing. It seems to cause more trouble. Did you guys decide who was going first?
Hi, my name is Delia. I'm an alcoholic.
Delia.
Hi. Goodness. So thank you for inviting me here. This is definitely a scary prospect to look at, fear and sex. I don't like to admit that I am a fearful person. I like to believe that I am strong and that I can handle anything, but that's the facade that I want others to see. But in reality, this paragraph has been like hitting me in different directions recently. I've confronted a lot of fears And I never really thought about the idea when it talks about stealing, categorizing it as stealing. And yet, like, when I look at it, when I take inventory about my fears, I see that it steals my joy. It steals my peace of mind. It steals my gratitude. It steals the faith that I've gained in recovery. And when I give fear that kind of power, it corrodes my life. You know, these words written are so powerful, and yet, like, I don't even see it sometimes until I'm looking backwards, or until I've hit a brick wall, or until I'm on my knees praying to my higher power, stop. Can you help me to stop this? It sets in motion trains of circumstances which brought us misfortune we felt we didn't deserve. I think about that. When I think about that, I think about my insecurities. I think about how my lack of confidence, my self-esteem, can create scenarios in my head. I can misinterpret information. I can misinterpret situations because I am not self-confident. I am not secure, whether that be financial security, whether that be emotional security. And so what happens when I am insecure is I tend to live in the past, and I tend to live in the future. And I think about what could happen, or what might happen, or I think about what has already happened, and I replay that. And as a result, I either react insane, outwardly or inwardly. I can, you know, my feelings and my emotions are, when they're attached to fear, I react differently. And so I set these scenarios in my head, and then all of a sudden I am going this way on a different trajectory, and that's not where I was 10 minutes ago, or a day ago, or a week ago. And sometimes I think, well, why is this happening to me? You know, aren't I doing all the right things and stuff? But fear for me is definitely, can be the driver in my life. And when that drives me, it usually drives me in the wrong direction. It does not drive me towards my higher power. It does not drive me towards serenity. It does not drive me towards faith. But I'm human, so it happens. So I do have a lot of trouble redirecting that fear sometimes. But what I do today is I look at that fear and I confront it, and I say, what is the evidence? Is the evidence real, or is the evidence made up? And when I can see the evidence, then I can see what actions I need to take. So that's all I got.
Thanks, Toby.
Hey, everybody. Toby, I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Toby.
To start that off, right? Can I start off with saying I'm scared up here? I'm worried about saying the wrong thing in front of a whole bunch of people. I also heard it from quite a few people in AA, some old timers be like, careful every time you speak, because it could be the last words an alcoholic might hear. And so, you know, I try to carry the message of my experience, strength, and hope. And I also pray for, you know, God to guide my words. And hopefully the right thing comes out. And what came to mind when I read this was, I love that sentence, you know, fear ought to be classed with stealing, because it's such a horrible thing to be afraid in the world. And for me, what that looks like is self-delusion, self-seeking, and self-pity. The fear is going to lead me into, I'm afraid of whatever's going to happen. And then the self-delusion is, I know what's going to happen. Right? This is what's going to happen. My mind tells me this is what's going to happen. I have no idea. I can't tell the future. And then that goes into the self-seeking thing where I'm like, well, I'm going to protect myself from this fear. Right? And so I'm going to either hide myself away or I'm going to take an action without the guidance of, you know, some kind of, is this going to hurt somebody? Because when I'm protecting myself, I'm not worried about anybody else in my life. I'm only worried about me and maybe mine, right? Me and my family or my friends or me and, you know, I don't care if somebody gets hurt in that moment, at that moment in time. I'm in protector mode. And so for me, it's like, all right, get whatever it is that's bad away from me as fast as possible and by whatever means. And that was the old me. And then when I would take those actions and they would hurt somebody, I would get real, real sad. That guilt and that shame that I think we're all famous for is builds. It builds. And then I get afraid of saying sorry to the person because I done hurt somebody at the same time. So now it's just a vicious cycle, right? I'm afraid of even telling the truth to somebody because I don't want to let that person down, or I'm afraid of what they're going to do to me based on the fact that I hurt them out of self-protection. When I'm talking about fear, and there's healthy fears. You know, like I don't want to touch a burning stove. I only had to do that one time to figure out I didn't want to do it anymore. You know, there's healthy fears. I don't want to jump off a building because I know I'm not going to land very well. I don't have wings. I can't fly. You know, those are healthy. Like, it's okay to have healthy, that's a healthy thing. Self-protection, that kind of thing. It's when I'm unjustifiably protecting what I think might happen. Those are the fears that I don't know. I have no idea. I'm sitting around wallowing in this fear. Like, I don't know what's going to happen if I go and tell my boss that, you know, I broke this part. Right? But in all actuality, he's going to look at me like, okay, he would appreciate honesty more than he would me hiding the broken part and him finding it 3 days later. You know? That he would not like that at all. I find that fear leads to lying a lot, too. That self-protection, that ego protection. Even in AA. Even in AA. I'll lie to your face to make me look better than you. Right? It can happen at times. I get overinflated ego, right? I got to make myself feel good. I got this program, right? I got spirituality. Look at me, you know? Instead of just being myself and being honest and open, I've done that before, you know, to try to get a newcomer to grasp on to something that maybe they're not even ready to look at. Preach to the masses, this is how it's got to be done, you know? I can't do that. I can only tell you what worked for me. And I know that fear today is a lot less of a problem than what it was, but I am human as well, and I still have some every now and again. But I think that third step in me giving my life over to the care of God, as I understand Him, my life and my will, my thoughts and my actions, to the best of my ability, I'm nowhere near perfect, really mitigates a lot of those fears, because the more I align my thoughts and my actions to God's will, the better actions and the better thoughts I have. I'll take better actions. And therefore, because I take better actions for myself, I will have less fear because I'm doing the right thing. You know, a lot of the times, all the fears that came out of my life, just about every single one of them, except for the ones that came from my childhood, they were manifested by me taking an action that I knew I probably shouldn't have took at the time. When I look back at every single one of my actions that caused me these heinous things in my life, you know, all these things that I thought the world was against me. When I look back at these things, I see, I had this thought back then and I didn't even pay any attention to it. I was just looking out for me. Whether that comes to hurting somebody or, you know, stealing something, or taking that drink, or taking that drug, breaking something somebody else's, punching a guy in the face. I was afraid of my buddies looking at me like I was a wuss, you know? All these things are based on fear instead of doing the right thing. Because I didn't have a higher power guide my life back then. Today I do. Thanks for
awesome. Okay, we're going to continue reading on page 68. Perhaps there's a better way. We think so. For we're now on a different basis, the basis of trusting and relying upon God. We trust infinite God rather than our finite selves. We are in the world to play the role he assigns. Just to the extent that we do as we think he would have us and humbly rely on him, does he enable us to match calamity with serenity. We never apologize to anyone for depending upon our Creator. We can laugh at those who think spirituality the way of weakness. Paradoxically, it is the way of strength. The verdict of the ages is that faith means courage. All men of faith have courage. They trust their God. We never apologize for God. Instead, we let him demonstrate through us what he can do. We ask him to remove our fear and direct our attention to what he would have us be. At once, we commence to outgrow fear. Delia?
That's a really good two paragraphs. So this reminds me of one of my experiences in early recovery. I was probably coming up on my 2 years, and financial security was still like not there. I didn't have any financial security at 2 years. I was working at that time the Marriott at the front desk with a, you know, bachelor's degree from UVA, and I, you know, hated myself for getting to that place, you know, and yet like I was taking directions and taking suggestions, and when the time came to go back for my nursing license, I remember finally getting through it, and what, you know, for me, like what I know today is that I cannot rely just on my own thoughts, just on my own knowledge. So when it talks about the finite self, like that is finite for me, like my thoughts, my knowledge, what I have within me, that's finite. And it talks about relying on God. And so if I am not God, then I know today that God is infinite, infinite possibilities, infinite solutions. And so when I was getting ready to transition to my nursing life, I was interviewing different places, different employers. And at that time I was, for lack of better terms, I was mandated to do a monitoring program for 5 years. Well, that doesn't look good when you're going to an employer and saying, hey, by the way, like, hire me, but know that you have to, you know, do documentations for me weekly, monthly. You have to, you know, put me on a probationary period because I can't give narcotics for 90 days. I can't work overtime. I can't work night shifts, but please hire me, you know? And like, that was not easy to go to an employer and say, yes, this is what I have. And I got a lot of closed doors because of that. And it got very discouraging. It got very scary because my thoughts, my fearful thoughts were like, no one's ever gonna hire me. This is never gonna change. This is never gonna get better. And thank God for this program. Thank God for my sponsor. Thank God for recovery, because even though I had those fears, you know, I commenced to outgrow fear because I kept praying. I kept asking God, okay, God, like, show me what the next step is. Guide me to the next step, you know? And at some point I had this thought, volunteer at the hospital. That was the thought, right? Like, volunteer. So that's what I started to do. I started to volunteer at this hospital, still applying for jobs. And sure enough, that volunteer position got me connected to a manager who had seen me, who had talked to me, who had known my situation, and she knew that I was struggling trying to find a job. And I had to be humble. I had to be honest with this person about my situation. And sure enough, a couple months later, she knew of another manager who was hiring, and she said, go upstairs, go and interview right now. So I'm in this black cat slacks and my bright red volunteer shirt, and I was not prepared at all to interview with this person. And yet, like, that was God's, for me, that was God's way of saying, this is your next step, right? And so I had this interview, and I had an opportunity to tell this person my truth about my situation, and I didn't, because fear crept in. Fear got the best of me in that moment, and because of my past experiences, well, when you tell the truth, they're not gonna hire you. That's what was going on in my head. So I was like, so I just didn't say anything. I withheld that information. If you stay sober long enough, maybe you'll have the same experience that I had. What I had was, I had conscience, right? The conscience kicked in, and it was an hour later, and I was like, crap, why didn't I just tell him the truth? I have to tell him the truth, right? Because he had offered me a position, but I didn't tell him the full truth. I didn't tell him what that meant to hire me. And as it is, you know, like, the God of my understanding knows what I need when I need it. And even when I don't want to do it the right thing, he's going to present opportunities for me to do the right thing. So that day, I was supposed to leave my volunteer and go to the Marriott. But before I went, I said, I need to get food. So I went to the cafeteria. And sure enough, the manager that interviewed was sitting right there. And I said, okay. Shoot. Right? Because I had prayed. I was like, all right, God, give me the courage to do the right thing. You know, my idea was, I'll call him later. That was my idea. God's idea was like, no, you're going to tell him now. So again, I humbled myself and I walked up to him and I said, thank you for offering me the position, but I wasn't honest with you. And I need to be honest with you. And I laid it out. Right? I laid it out. And his response was not what I expected. I expected him to say, thank you. We don't want you. We'll find somebody else. His response was, you should have told me that upstairs. but thank you for telling me now. And he said, you know, my wife and I have asked ourselves how we would handle this situation if it ever came across. And we decided that we would support the nurse in this monitoring program. So you can still, your job is still there if you want it. And I will work with you 100%. And that was just, for me, jaw dropping, because that doesn't happen, right? If I continue to let my fear drive me and trust my finite self, I would have never talked to him. And then, like Toby said, I would have tried to cover it up. I would have tried to make more lies upon lies, and it just wouldn't work, right? So for me, the only way I can commence to outgrow fear is to, it says, to ask God what he would have us be, have me be, and I have to be honest. I have to be truthful. I have to be faithful. I have to be courageous. I have to be all of these things that these principles teach me in order to have that kind of life. If I'm not willing to practice these principles, then I can't expect to have that kind of life today. So that's all I got. Thanks.
Now, what it brought to my mind was was when I was 2 months sober and I had done 1, 2, and 3 with a temporary sponsor right off the bat. This was like my big awakening after 2 times in the rooms, separated by about 5 years apiece. And I had to have my wife arrested for domestic violence. My wife at the time, the now ex-wife. And at the time, it was just like, go away. I had woken up to something in the program, and it was, I'm not going to live like this anymore. And I had to protect my children in that. And a single father in United States Navy, and was lucky to be on shore duty at the time when this happened. And I went and I had to tell my boss that I had her arrested, and there was a protective order out for about 2 weeks, and I had to take care of the children. And I was like, I was scared. Like, I didn't know, because in the Navy, if you're not there, you're like, oh, you know, you can't be held accountable for anything, or they kick you out if you can't perform your duty. And and I told him I was sober 60 days at the same time for some strange reason. I have no idea why I told him I've been sober for 60. I think he might have asked me if I had been drinking or something like that. And I was like, no, I've been sober for 60 days. He's like, oh yeah? All right, well, you got that going on. We're gonna let you go take care of that. When you get back, you gotta go see the DAPA guy, the drug and alcohol program advisor guy. And I was like, why do I gotta go see him? I've been sober for like 60 days. He's like, you gotta go see him. I was like, okay. So I go and take care of everything. And within the matter of, I'm searching around the Navy bases for daycare, and all of them are filled. There's no spots available for a year and a half year old daughter. And I live in Virginia Beach, and I had to drive to Norfolk too. And I'm searching all over the place, and I'm calling all of them. They're like, no spots available, no spots available. And I was like, you know what? Forget it. I'm just going to go and talk to one of these people. For some reason, the thought came into my head, go to the daycare on Little Creek and talk to these people. And I go up there, and I start talking to them. I'm like, look, I'm in this situation right now. Like, this is happening. and I go there, and it turns out right when I showed up, somebody had went in to disenroll their child that day, and so my child could get that emergency taken over spot, and I was able to go to work. And for the next, you know, it's 7-8 months of court litigations, I didn't have babysitters. I couldn't afford babysitters. The daycare took all my money. I wasn't making that much. And one of the ladies at the daycare offered her services to take my child home with her when she left the daycare, when I couldn't get off of work early enough to come pick her up, and took her to the house to watch her until I would get home. And this included when I needed to go to AA meetings, and she wasn't an alcoholic. This included when the courts mandated me to go to this thing called Fathers in Training every single Monday night for 15 weeks from like 7 to 9, and I got a 1.5-year-old and a 9-year-old at home. And I'm like, what am I gonna do? Oh, you gotta get a babysitter. And I had nobody here. And I had to do this for 6 months. At 6 months in, I got orders to go to sea duty. And I was like, oh God, what am I gonna do? I got nobody, because this is a child abuse neglect case and she can't see her. I called my youngest brother in Illinois. I was like, well, let me see. You know, I haven't talked to him in 2.5 years, see how he's doing. I call my youngest brother up, and I'm like, hey man, what are you doing right now? And he's like, well, not much. I said, you still working at Pizza Hut, whatever? And he's like, no, man. I said, well, man, I need some help right now. I need some serious help. This is what's going on. I'm divorced and Navy. I need somebody to come down and help me take care of the kids and this and that. And he's like, you know what's funny? Is I just quit that job, and I got nowhere else to go. I'm just kind of just sitting here doing nothing. Sure, why not? 3 days later, he drove down from Northern Illinois to live with me and help me raise my kids for 1.5 years until my middle brother just so happened to come down. And all this time, like, I'm just trying to do the next right thing put in front of me and follow through with these programs. You know, I got admitted to SARP at 9 months of sobriety. Like, that was an amazing experience. Going into a rehab with sobriety was a whole other thing. I got to find out that I like to control groups of people. Yeah, I was one of the counselors pointing out. I was like, because I would be around these people who, you know, they had like 10, 20, 30 days of sobriety maybe, you know, or they were made to go in there, so they were, you know, sobriety And I'm like telling him, this is what's going on, blah, blah, blah. And she's like, you're controlling everybody. And I'm like, no way. I'm just trying to help them. And they're like, no, you're controlling them to fulfill your own sick self-worth thing. It's sick. Stop it. I was like, okay. All right. Humility, that thing that I didn't have, it was funny. It was a fear of not, boils right down into a fear of not feeling important, a fear of not fitting in, a fear of not being understood. And to this day, when I'm not guided by God, I really, really over-explain things a lot. And I go, this is right. Not just like, yeah, they could even agree with me, be like, yeah, you're right. And I'll be like, yeah, but this is why I'm right, blah, 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 blah. Like, as if them saying they're right isn't enough, what am I doing? It's funny. Trusting, that's when I'm in that trust in my singular self, me, just me. I got the show at that point in time. I definitely lean on this guy a lot, because I got to feel confidence in me. But when I'm not guided by the right thoughts or actions, right? When I'm not relying on that infinite God, this power that got me sober and saved the lives of my children, when I'm not relying on that, I go right back to the old guy. It happens. It's a gradual thing. But I go back to him. And just, if anything's taught me in sobriety is that working this program and even rereading the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous is extremely important. Extremely important. The more I read and the more I get to share and the more I get to help, the more I learn about me. And it's an amazing experience. Relying upon, like I said, God. I gotta let him play that role. There's a lot of things going on in my life right now. And surprisingly, I am not freaking out. There's a pending court case. I got to get the deed to my house signed by my ex-wife. We're going to move in a year. I'm engaged. I have a year and a half left in the Navy. All these things. And all those things will swirl up into my head. And what am I going to do about money? Right? You know what? As far as I've been alive, things have kind of worked out. And I really didn't have a whole lot to do with them. I just suited up and I showed up and things just kind of happened. That went all the way from high school all the way up to here. Even though I was drunk for, 12 of those years, something kept me alive. And I sure as hell didn't do it. I was trying to kill me out there. I must not be good at that.
All right. We're going to continue on page 68. Now, about sex. Many of us needed an overhauling there, but above all, we tried to be sensible on this question. It's so easy to get way off track. Here we find human opinions running to extremes, absurd extremes, perhaps. One set of voices cries that sex is a lust of our lower nature, a base necessity of procreation. Then we have the voices who cry for sex and more sex, who bewail the institution of marriage, who think that most of the troubles of the race are traceable to sex causes. They think we don't have enough of it or that it isn't the right kind. They see its significance everywhere. One school would allow man no flavor for his fare, and the other would have us all on a straight pepper diet. We want to stay out of this controversy. We do not want to be the arbiters of anyone's sex conduct. We all have sex problems. We'd hardly be human if we didn't. What can we do about them?
Delia?
Let's see. Wow. That's, I didn't really like this part of the inventory. This was probably the hardest part of my inventory because I created this image of myself and I failed at that. Let's just be honest. I appreciate today, knowing that I'm not the only one with sex problems. And I am also grateful to know that my experiences don't make me who I am today. A couple of years ago, I returned from a 3-month trip to Guatemala, and what happened when I got back, I had not planned on. I was not ready for. But I found myself using sex and the feelings attached to it for that ease and comfort. And I was not even intentionally trying to do that. I was trying to do this dating thing, dating outside of the program thing. And what I realized is that sex and fear were connected to each other. The fear of not being loved, the fear of not being wanted, the fear of not having the relationships that I saw everybody else having, the fear of, not getting what I want kind of crept up and hit me hard. And I realized that in my last, at that point, 6 years, 7 years of my recovery, I had done a lot of sex ideals, because I've taken a couple of inventories, and that's what it suggests, is to write a sex ideal. And I had not lived up to that. And I found myself with men, and I wanted certain things, but I wasn't willing to, quote unquote, work for them. I would get myself in these positions, and then ask myself, well, how did I get here? And I went back and forth between, is this right or this wrong? Is this what I'm supposed to do, or is this what I'm not supposed to do? And, you know, that's a really tough place to be. I ended up having to take another inventory about that area of my life, and I really had to go back to step one, step two, and step three, and see where I was powerless, what was unmanageable, how I was insane in that area, and then how I could let the God of my understanding take me to what I really am looking for. Because me, again, on my own, I can't, I don't know, as my sponsors have always said, like, my picker is broken. So I will pick the wrong people, the wrong ideas. And so I need to connect with my higher power. I need to speak to my sponsor. I need to really be honest about what I need and want. And then I have to be willing to be patient. And to really, for me, I have to let go of that fear of, if I don't do this, then I won't get what I want. That's what goes in my head, is that I have to do certain things, and don't take that the wrong way, but like, I have to, you know, let's just say, get in bed with a guy to have a relationship. Like, that is an old idea. And that is something that I've had to confront and say, no, that's not what I believe. No, that's not what I want. And then to make that belief and that want match, I have to take that action. You know, so my sponsors have always said, my last sponsor, she would say, date them for 90 days. You know? Go to X number of dates. You know? And I would have to take those actions. And, you know, that sometimes that's not easy because I like instant gratification. I like that ease and comfort. I like, you know, I don't know. I like to feel good. And but that for me, that has always come at a cost. And today I'm not willing to put that price on my dignity, my self-respect. Today I value myself much differently than I did in the past. So that's all I got. Thanks.
Sex. I said it. It's scary to guys, isn't it? You know? I think it's scary to everybody, especially when they start talking about it a little bit, you know? That you got to do it the right way, in the right position, for the right reasons, only to have babies, or everybody should do it with everybody else, or there's a somewhere in between. And I don't know if I had any kind of real ideal growing up. I know what I got taught was I was raised pretty much by my mother, but she also married three men along the way. Actually, four. The fourth one was when I was like 16. He's more like a cool silver homie. He's an old dude. He's awesome. But the first three were not really all that good, and they weren't great. And so I got taught that staying in a relationship meant that you probably had to have sex so you could stay financially secure. That was hers, but also that I had to have respect for women. I had to have this huge respect for women. And then that guy also watched, you know, videos and had magazines to keep it clean in the house of God. And, you know, as young boys, we were pretty mischievous and we found these magazines and these boys. And so I got this idea of what a woman was supposed to look like and what a woman was supposed to do and all these things, right? And so this was my teacher because I had a mother and a crappy stepfather that I didn't want to talk about it. And, you know, didn't find it important to talk about it. I had these things, and this is what it was supposed to be like. And a guy is supposed to go out there and do these things, right? Thank God I was socially inept, right? I would have caused a lot more damage than I did. So I did cause some, but it wasn't really as bad as I thought it was when I got to this part of the book. And I guess I've been blessed that way. When I looked at this, and it's part of the next paragraph, so I won't get into it now, but when we're talking about, I had a lot of sex problems with this warped point of view. I got to look at where my ideas came from. Where did they come from? My grandparents that said I couldn't even say poo in her house without it being a sin. And then I had a mother who didn't even go to church. And then I had this stepfather who watched these videos. Where's the right idea? And then all the guys in school, right? I'm a young boy growing up, coming into young manhood, are talking about what are we doing with Susie or Mary or whoever, right? This is what they're talking about. And what are we doing? And then, you know, hey, come over to my homie's house, my buddy's house, my best friend's house, and his dad's got videos, and we're watching them together. What are we doing that for? You know, pants on, everything, okay? Right? And then I also had this other thing, you know, where when I was a young kid, I was like 10, 11 years old, I was in a barn with some farm boys, and this was, you know, this is what young boys do, I guess, out on the farm. They just finding out what's going on. And so that conflicted me for a long time. I got some outside help with that, because Lord knows I wouldn't come in a room in Alcoholics Anonymous and ask y'all for some help with that one, but they just said that was pretty normal for young boys around that age, you know? It was a natural thing, I guess. So, you know, just to find out what was going on. We didn't do anything, but hey, you know, part of that fifth step. Oh man, I just scared you. If you're worried about a fifth step, well, there's a big one, right? I'm a guy and I just said I was in a barn with a couple of boys. All right? Yeah. Be scared about a fifth step now. But here we go. You know, when we're talking about this stuff, there's the ideas. I didn't have an idea. So I just went along with whatever I saw, what I thought was acceptable socially, right? With the group of people that I was with at that time. Because I was one of those people trying to fit in. Because I didn't. I was inept socially unless I was drinking. And even then, I was pretty... I could get to that point, and then people didn't want me around no more, you know? So... I was continuing on here.
Okay.
Pretty good there, thanks, Dave.
Where are we here?
I think we're short on time. I'm gonna just cherry pick a couple of paragraphs, and then that'll leave you guys a couple more minutes. Okay. So page 69. We reviewed our conduct over years past. Where had we been selfish, dishonest, or inconsiderate? Whom had we hurt? Did we unjustifiably arouse jealousy, suspicion, or bitterness? Where were we at fault? What should we have done instead? We got this all down on paper and looked at it. And on page 70, to sum up about sex, we earnestly pray for the right ideal, for guidance in each questionable situation, for sanity and for strength to do the right thing. If sex is very troublesome, listening? If sex is very troublesome, we throw ourselves the harder into helping others. We think of their needs and work for them. This takes us out of ourselves. It quiets the imperious urge when to yield would mean heartache. In this book, you will read again and again that faith did for us what we could not do for ourselves. We hope you are convinced now that God can remove whatever self-will has blocked you off from him. If you've already made a decision and an inventory of your grosser handicaps, you've made a good beginning. That being so, you have swallowed and digested some big chunks of truth about yourself.
Hmm. Yeah, those three paragraphs are, you know, when I do my inventory and I ask myself those questions, whether I'm selfish, dishonest, or inconsiderate, you know, I certainly don't like to admit those things. And yet, like, when I do admit it, when I do tell on myself, then I have the opportunity to change. Because if I don't admit that there's a problem, then I'll continue to do the same behaviors. If I am not willing to see my part in all situations, then I'm still kind of telling God, not yet, right? Not yet. And those questions are not easy to answer, you know, but the questions that, you know, that says, what can I do differently? I think that's the hope that I need, right? Because my mind and my disease can work overtime, and I can believe that it's never going to change, right? That I'm doomed. That's what my disease wants me to believe about my drinking, about my sex life, about my fears, right? But my disease is cunning, baffling, and powerful. And I know that today the God of my understanding is so much bigger than my disease, right? And so when it says for me that God is going to do what I cannot do for myself, you know, that takes me back to that third step. Like, am I ready to completely abandon myself to my higher power? Am I really ready to let go of what I think I need or want? Right, because if I'm not, then God can't do for me what God needs to do for me. Right, God has given me that willpower and the freedom to use that willpower. But for me, I know that when it says, you know, that we throw ourselves harder into helping others, I know that every time I get to a place where a relationship has failed for whatever reason, God always seems to put in somebody in my life who has asked me for help. And I don't know how it works, but it does say here that I try to think of them and their needs and work for that. And for some reason, that gets me out of my head, gets me out of my, that imperious urge. Like, I don't react. And so instead, I work with a sponsee, and I hear them share their fears, and I hear them share their experiences, and then I get to share mine, you know? And that for me, you know, allows me to accept myself as I am, accept my life as it is right now, and then it allows me to share the hope, right? The hope that I find by staying sober, by coming to AA continuously, and by trusting my higher power. So that's all I got. Thanks.
Thank you.
Hey everybody, this is one of my favorite subjects right here, doing this sound and sex ideal thing, and I got short, so you know, if you want to come talk to me, because there's this thing with the men, I think, that don't really want to face the truth when it comes to sex and their sex and how they perform sex and why they perform sex. And I believe that's a hard thing to do, just for anybody, not just men, but also women as well. When we get to this part of the fourth step, a lot of people tend to shy away or hide things. And they don't want to tell the truth about things. And we don't want to list out every single relation that we've had. It says we list out all the relations. Now, I identified that as any time I had physical intercourse with another person. Okay? So I had to subject every single one of these times to this ideal. I got to look at this and see if it was selfish or not. So I look at this and I say, hey, was it selfish? Yeah, I want to say before I formed an idea of what my sex conduct should be, every single one of my times before that was selfish and self-centered. And it was all based not in the fulfillment of helping somebody else feel better or sharing an intimate relationship with somebody on the most intimate level. It was all based on the fact that I wanted to fulfill some holding on to somebody, that was one of them. I'm lonely and I don't want you to go nowhere, so we're gonna do this. And because I do this, you're gonna get attached to me, and so you stay with me. Or I'm gonna do it so I can brag about it with my boys to fulfill some kind of sense of self-worth there, ego feeding. Or I'm afraid that you're gonna leave me. Another loneliness thing. Or that if I get you, like I said before, and we do this, you're gonna stay. There were these big things that permeated all of my relationships, all of my sick relationships, and it was that. It was based on my sex conduct. Everything that happened in my adulthood besides the drinking permeated from these relationships with these women. And they were all based on something, me reaching out for something and then keeping it. And almost every single time I performed sex, it was for a selfish, self-centered reason. And I had to form an idea that I can't do that anymore if I want to change who I am. What kind of person do I want to attract in my life? Who do I want to spend the rest of my life with? And it's none of those values that I was doing in any of those relationships. So I had to change my ideals to what I believe God wanted me to have, which was an idea of a sex relationship that I could perform this for somebody else, to share it with somebody else, not withholding it for any other reason, and to doing it just complete, like trying to do it out of selflessness at times, and other times, you know, for mutual gratification. Like, it was just a thing. Like there's an idea out there that actually works and fulfills an emotional need too. And this is an amazing thing to have. It's an amazing thing when it happens. And I know, I've known and I've heard some stories where it's just, this is the most unemotional sex I've ever had. Like, you know what I mean? Like those, that's sick. It's self-gratification, instantaneous. That's when I should be throwing myself into helping others, you know, stuff like that. If I'm not getting, every time I make that connection with somebody, if I make that connection, it is the most intimate relationship I can have with another person, period, if, ands, or buts. And if I'm doing that out of purely selfish reasons, imagine the damage I can cause to that person. And if that person has a husband, and if that person has children, or if I had a wife and I had children, all that damage that I'm causing to everybody else around him, even if it's a single girl for the first time, that damage. The damage, is it right? Is it selfish? That's where me feeding into that sexual urge has nothing to do with a relationship to somebody else. It's only self-gratification. To have a friend first and to know that person is special is probably the most important thing I learned out of this chapter right here with that sex thing. Is I need to have somebody I know first. It can't just be about getting my jollies. I can do that all day long. What is that? Real quick, dude. Real quick, David. I love this. Joe and Charlie, and I love this phrase. We had a sponsee ask somebody, like, hey, when can I have sex? They told me I couldn't have sex in my first year. And he says, well, you can have all the sex you want in your first year. In your second year, you can have it with other people. You know? So it was just a great joke. Thanks for letting me share.
Yeah, thank you. We're going to pass the seven tradition baskets. The seven tradition, every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. While contributions cover each level of AA service, it's both a privilege and a responsibility for groups and members to ensure that not only their group, but also their intergroup, central office, local services, district, area, general service office remain self-supporting. This keeps AA free of outside influences that might divert us from our primary purpose to help the alcoholic who still suffers. Although the amount of our contribution is secondary to the spiritual connection that unites all groups around the world, we may want to remember that a dollar doesn't support as many services as it used to. Are there any announcements, quick announcements, for the good of AA? No? Great. Simple Actions is a home group. If you're interested in joining our home group, please see one of us after the meeting. Home group members, raise your hands. Newcomers, you are the reason why we are here, why we meet. Is there anyone here tonight in their first 30 days of sobriety who would like to welcome you?
My name is Tilden. I'm an alcoholic.
Thanks, Tilden.
Welcome.
My
name's
Derek.
I'm an
alcoholic.
Hey, Derek. Welcome.
Hey, Derek. Welcome. I'm feeling like two more.
Hi, Dan.
Hi, Dan.
Sheldon, welcome.
Hey, Sheldon.
Anybody else? Okay. There is literature available. Please see a home group member. If you can fold it, it's free. If you'd like to buy a book, just see any one of us. We'll help you out. Sponsorship in AA is yours for the asking. We urge you, do not delay. If you have questions or would like additional information about sponsorship, I'll be available at this table after we close the meeting. Please feel free to talk to me. Smokers, please use the butt can provided outside and stay well away from the church doors. All meeting audio recordings and upcoming events are posted to our website, simpleactions.net. Let's see. I want to thank everyone who participated. After we clean up, all are invited and encouraged to continue the conversation on the step discussed tonight at the meeting after the meeting, which will be held at Plaza del Sol on 22nd and Colonial. And I have to say that of all the talks that we do in this room, the one tonight on fear and sex is probably the toughest one. So thank you guys for coming to share. May I please have a volunteer to read the last two paragraphs on 164?
Hi, Ebony, I'm an alcoholic.
Thank you, Ebony.
Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answer will come, if your own house is in order. But obviously, you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then.
Amen. Mm-hmm. It's got in front of the table.
Bye.
Circle up.
Thank you.
Temptation.